So, welcome. We're going to open this session of the Senate Interim Committee on General Government Accountability. First thing we have is we need to adopt committee rules. Diane, do you have anything to say about that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I assume by this point most of the members have been in a committee where they've discussed the rules, but I'm available to summarize or answer questions if there's any issue at all. They're substantially similar to the last interim rules.
I think everybody's familiar.
So, Chair Riley, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today, September 18th, 2017.
So, Senator DeBoer moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today. Any discussion? Any objections? The rules are adopted. So what do we have first?
Mr. Chair, there are three topics up for discussion during your informational meeting today, and I believe you were entertaining reordering the agenda.
Yes, that's correct. So we are going to do the elections integrity and security portion first to get that out of the way. So if we could go ahead and start with that, if the elections folks would want to come up. Thank you for being here. If you, when we get started, if you could introduce yourselves for the record, but do you have a summary of what we're going to discuss, or?
No, Mr. Chair. I know that Mr. Trout and Ms. Vasa are here to
Great.
Provide their expertise.
Okay, thank you. So whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Steve Trout, State Election Director, here with Lisa Vasa, our Chief Information Security Officer for the Secretary of State. Thank you for the opportunity to come and discuss security integrity of elections. Been in the news lately and a lot of interest, and so hopefully we can answer your questions and share the good things that we're doing to protect elections and the voting process here in Oregon. And so really, when you look at election security and integrity, there's really two components to it. There's the technological component that Ms. Voss is going to discuss here shortly, and then there's a procedural and process component that are implemented either in our office or in the county clerk offices that allow for protections, access controls, security, physical security of buildings and equipment, and then like backup processes for like when there's an online registration, there's a paper copy that's followed or a paper form that is followed up to make sure that any activities that are happening, there's a paper trail to record that and for voters to be able to have confidence and to be able to have that confirmed. And so a lot of the discussion out in the media is talking about the technology security, but I think actually the procedural and the physical security is one of the biggest components that we have that allows us to protect elections. Again, in Oregon, everything's vote by mail, all paper, and so we don't have any voting tally systems that are connected to the internet. Those are all freestanding in the county election offices, so they can't be touched from outside. So again, you would need physical access and in order to be able to do any tampering with those voting systems. So really, we've got those voting systems out in the counties that we have those physical and procedural connections. And then I think the things that we have in our office around OCVR, our voter registration database, the technology tools that we have there to make sure that we're insulated from attacks from the outside. We've been doing a good job at doing that, but I'll turn it over to Ms. Vasa to describe some of those tools and processes that we go through to protect the integrity of the voter registration database.
Okay.
Go ahead, Senator.
Go ahead.
All right. I'm Lisa Vasa, Chief Information Security Officer for Secretary of State. And I just wanted to note that for our election systems, as well election-related systems, particularly voter registration, as well as our other SOS systems, we have layers of defense to protect us. It's not just one answer that's supposed to be the one-size-fits-all. We start with our network firewalls. which are there to monitor and prevent unauthorized access to our systems. We block for a variety of reasons, including our geographic location, suspicious behavior, known malicious IPs, and then potentially interesting events, if you will, or security policy violations. Our network firewalls block about 14 million events per day. So that's just the bad guys trying to get in, poking at our network, saying, hey, we'd like to see what you've got going on. We block that as a matter of course. If they get past that, which legitimate requests may, we have an additional layer of security called a web application firewall. This protects our public-facing web applications. Now, blocks in that system, there's fewer because, of course, less stuff gets through to get blocked. But it's based, again, on geographic location as well as behaviors. If someone sends us a request that doesn't make any sense to the system, it gets blocked and thrown out. We block an average of about 17,000 requests with our web application firewall each day. Then, if you've got into our network and you're actually doing something, we have a log correlation and collection system that pulls in information from all over our SOS systems, whether it's our web servers, our database servers, our workstations, firewalls, our load balancing, and so forth. So from those events, we have analytics, machine analytics, to pull out the stuff that's interesting. As you can imagine, we have millions, about 25 million events per day that come into that log correlation engine. From there, machine analytics weeds through it to see if there's anything interesting. Some of those rules are rules we've made specific to our application. Some of those rules are things that come with the system that help us to identify what's interesting and what isn't. We manually investigate between 80 and 100 events per day that somehow got flagged and don't look right. So once we've done that, we have other things that we're doing. We run vulnerability scans on our workstations and our servers, approximately 450 scans per week on 250 network-attached devices. So most weeks, most devices get scanned more than once. Those help us identify vulnerabilities, things that we do need to fix. It helps us identify by criticality, and it tells us that that is on our system. We also get threat information from a variety of external sources, which may or may not apply to our systems, but it helps us identify what's going on out in the real world and what might impact our systems. And so we have all this stuff in place to prevent infections. And then, since users are one of our biggest causes of data breaches out in the real world today, we also have implemented what we call host-based firewalls. So on your particular or any individual's particular workstation, if they do click on that phishing link, they are blocked from spreading that infection out to the network. And so those are some of the things that we have in place to protect our systems in general, including our voter registration system.
Thank you. So I want to go back to the counties. We have in this state counties that do all elections different. Every county is different. We have systems that are proprietary code inside those systems, inside those machines, although they're not connected to the internet. We don't know what that code is. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that is correct. Those systems, any system certified for use in the state of Oregon, and we go through a certification process that includes testing from a federally accredited lab. So we've been given, guarantees that certain tests have been conducted on these machines to ensure their strength and security.
And post-election, there are some process that's gone through to verify. For instance, some counties look at specific precincts or random precincts and count them by hand to see that they match. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. By state law, the counties, all of the counties will have to go through some manual count of ballots that were cast in that election. And so that is an audit that is built into state law for the election process in all counties.
Okay. One of the things that concerns me and has concerned me for some time is the fact that we don't know the code that's in those machines. There's proprietary code that we're not allowed to look at. We as a state do not know what code is in the machines that are counting our ballots. As a former programmer and analyst, I know that it's quite possible to set up code which changes as it runs and changes back if it wants to. This is a possibility, and we have no way of knowing what the code inside of our counting machines are. We just do not know. What can we do to ensure that those things are not happening in some very specific cases where there's possible outcomes that certain people might want? How do we make sure that doesn't happen?
So, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And again, as I opened with, the processes and the procedures, I think, are our best defense for that. And so in all of the counties, before they tally a single ballot for an election, they go through and do a test. Test that machine with an expected results outcome and run those ballots through and get that expected result. And then they can run that again anytime during the election period. They'll tally the live ballots, and then at the end, as we said, they'll run that test again, as well as confirm that with a hand count of a statistically significant, that's hard for me to say, I have to slow down, statistically significant sample, so that there can be confidence that we have checked and those processes have confirmed that the machines are counting the same during the process as they were when they were programmed with that initial test deck. And then again, with the physical security and needing access in order to make changes, we have logs of that and security protocols. We have cameras in every county except for one of those vote tally machines to make sure that during the election time when those live ballots are being scanned that we're recording anyone that would have access there and be able to do anything to those machines.
Okay, finally, does your agency, do you have people who go out and work with the counties to make sure that they're following the procedures properly?
So, Mr. Chairman, we have, we have those procedures. We have committees that meet to agree on those procedures. I'm usually in four or five different counties throughout Election Day. I'll go to some of their pre-election tests just to make sure that those procedures are followed. They're public, open to the public, and invitations are put out so that interested parties can come and be a check on that process as well.
Okay. Any questions? Yes, Senator Thatcher.
I've always kind of thought it would be a good idea. Well, okay, backing up a little bit. A lot of conversations with the state CIO have taken place in this building, and he talks a lot about, well, I remember him talking a few times about white hat hackers, where they can test vulnerabilities. And I'm thinking, why wouldn't we employ something like that at least occasionally in the election system, simply to look at from registering to vote to, you know, people who have already been, the whole process, just to test where any vulnerabilities may be, if any.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Thatcher, I appreciate that, and I think, you know, any testing that we can do of that process would be valuable, especially if that builds confidence in the process. As usual, the question is funds and access, and especially with 36 different counties, and as Senator Riley said, a little bit different ways of doing things throughout. But there are three voting system vendors certified in the state and six different versions of those voting systems that we would have to be able to test.
Those are voting systems. I'm talking about the whole process from registering, receiving a voter registration card, whatever, you know, method, if you're going to the DMV, whatever, signing up to vote, the receiving a ballot, voting the ballots, the whole thing, and then plus some of the vulnerabilities that may exist prior to some of the security measures that we have enacted in recent years that weren't in place when other people, many thousands of us, had registered to vote. So I'm not just talking about the what counts it. I'm talking about the whole thing, every little step. And obviously it couldn't be every county, but just to kind of spot check here and there, where possible, a whole system test. Is that something you would have to have a law to do, or is that something that you could choose to do, providing there are funds for it?
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Thatcher, I think we have the ability to test that today without a statutory change. Again, it's all on resources and available staff and tools. And you know, sharing that responsibility, because the election process is so shared between the state and the counties, with the state having the official voter registration file and data, online registration coming through the state, but then also the counties having those the vote tally systems, and being able to test those together as a system or separately. There's all kinds of testing that we could do that would just require more resources.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
So I'm not sure if this is open. I was looking at one of the emails that we received from the Secretary of State regarding the cases that were referred for fraud investigation. Or is that within our realm?
Absolutely.
So I'm just curious, it says in the press release that there are identified 46 voters who cast ballots not only in this state but in another state. What process did we use to identify those? I'm just curious as to how we know they voted in a different state.
All right. Mr. Chairman, Senator Brzezinski, thank you for that question. And it's been really, having new technology tools to be able to go across state lines and to compare these data files, which, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, we didn't have any tools that could even have the computing ability to do this. So there were 5 states that participated in a feasibility study to see if this was something that could be utilized in other areas. We tested over 11.5 million ballots or votes across those 5 states, and so used a number of things. So national change of address forms, Social Security death index, our own vital statistics from our state, from Washington, Colorado, and the Electronic Registration Information Center that we're a member of, that helps us with identifying voters that move between states and just keeps those records updated, because frankly a lot of people don't recognize that when they move, when they fill out their change of address form, it doesn't update their voter registration form or registration information in their state. And so we're trying to identify ways that we can keep the rolls as clean as possible. And this is one of the tools that we've been using, these different tools. And after having success with those over the last few years, some of us had the questions like, well, can we now compare other states' voter histories using the same tools to be able to identify potential double voters?
Follow-up. So is this number of 46 represent only those 5 states, or is this nationwide based on the pilot that was already done?
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brzezinski, those 46 is just within Oregon. So within those 5 states, there were 112, that doesn't mean that we had 46 out of 112. It would be about half of those because you had a match in another state. So 112 out of 11.5 million records that were verified. So again, 0.001% of were identified.
One follow up. So 11.5, whatever that million, that is for the 5 states. In other words, what I'm getting at is,
correct,
potentially if we had access for all 50 states, the number of 46 could be elevated?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brzezinski, yes. That's why we focused on the percentage, because we think that would probably hold, because it was pretty consistent with what we learned from this feasibility study.
Well, I'm glad you did that way.
Yeah, and if I can follow up on that a little bit myself, the 46 that we're talking about are potential.
Correct.
They're not verified that they're really duplicates at this point. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. We've turned those over to the Attorney General with the evidence that we have, and they get to decide and take the next steps, which is part of this feasibility study. So we'll be curious to see not only in Oregon but in the other four states, you know, what comes about of these investigations.
My assumption is that when this is all finished and we know, you know, if these were real or if they were not, that there'll be another press release telling us what the actuality was instead of the potential.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm sure that information will be made available. I think it will probably take a period of time, and some cases are going to be faster than others for investigations. That's out of our control, but obviously when cases are closed, we'll be happy to share that information.
Publicly. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. This has been very informative. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So next, I think we're going to move to our other informational meeting, and we're going to start with the family care health comments. Jeff Hetherington, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president and CEO of Family Care. I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for their invitation to testify on the Oregon Health Authority's communication plan. Family Care has a 34-year history of working collaboratively with the state to advance access to quality health care and has always been in good standing as a Medicaid contractor during that period. As the second largest care-coordinated organization, we provide integrated patient-centered care to approximately 120,000 people in a network of over 4,000 health care providers in the Tri-County area and a little bit in Marion County. The release of the communications plan itself, along with the emails and a prior version of the plan drafted in 2015 and the more robust plan in 2017, is a stunning example of government run amok and an unbelievable departure from the duty of the authority to fairly and impartially administer the Oregon Health Plan. The 2017 plan was crafted to involve the Department of Justice and third parties and was specifically designed, as stated in the plan, to discredit family care in the legislature, attack our credibility with the public, and undermine our mission to provide quality access to health care services for our members. I have attached on the back of our testimony a list of themes that were used in that plan, which I'm sure many of you have been visited with. None of those themes are accurate. Most of them would be what we call half-truths leading to a lie. And I will not go through them, but that's there for your information. At this point, we're very pleased with the governor's recent actions to restore the integrity of the authority's operation. Despite our current lawsuit, we look forward to working with the new administration, and despite past actions of the authority, we believe we can work with them to find some mutually agreeable paths forward whereby family care can continue its 34-year history of serving Oregon's Medicaid population. I would say, just for the record, you know, we are now dealing in this hearing with the past. We frankly look forward to a better future with the OHA. So I would thank you for your attention and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? No questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So then we're going to hear from the agency, Patrick Allen, the new director. Welcome. Be sure to state your name for the record. I'm sure you know how to do that. You've done it many times.
Once or twice. Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen. I'm the interim director of the Oregon Health Authority. I'd like to make just a couple of quick comments and then answer questions that that you might have. First, the governor tasked me with a very specific charge to work at the Oregon Health Authority to address transparency, accountability, and the wise use of public resources. OHA's mission matters to every Oregonian, and my intent and the work that I've done in the 2 weeks that I've been there has been to use that charge and those principles as a guide as we work to focus on our mission and the critical work that the agency does. The agency certainly has had challenges over the past while. The Family Care Communications Plan is not at all the kind of product that I would request as an agency head, nor have developed on my watch. And going forward, that's certainly nothing that is not the sort of thing that that the agency would pursue. I understand we have a lot of trust to rebuild with a wide variety of partners, many in this body included. I think what we've got right now, though, is an opportunity to close a chapter in the agency's history and open a new one. I share Mr. Hetherington's desire to see if we can do a reset on that relationship in particular, but really a reset with a variety of relationships the agency has to make sure that, again, we're able to focus on transparency, accountability, and the wise use of public resources. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions you might have.
So, one question I have is, what exactly is the job of a communications director in a state agency?
Well, a communications director, Chair Riley, in a state agency would be the person who would manage the work of the communications shop as that's constructed, and each communications shop in different agencies are built a little bit differently. But it would, you know, be the entity that would be responsible certainly for relationships with the press, often with work related to publications, education campaigns, those kinds of things. It can be a little bit broad depending on the nature of the agency.
So one of the things would be certainly education for the public. Is
certainly.
That, okay. Questions for Mr. Yes, Senator Hass.
Thank you. I was glad to hear, I guess, satisfied that the people who were involved in that episode were not just disciplined, but they were removed, and that you came on, and because of your strong reputation, that chapter is closed down. And so what I guess remains to be seen was whether the removal of those people will also remove a culture that allowed that, and I hope that's true, because moving forward, if we're to advance the story, we need a strong, healthy culture, and that's, I guess, brings me to these questions. We just passed in the legislature a cost containment measure, Senate Bill 1067, which merges OEB and PEB, and that's pretty tough stuff for people in a government agency to make that kind of change. And so I was just wondering if there was anything that you could tell us about that effort, and if there was anything to report where that is, how it's going on that front.
Certainly, Chair Riley, Senator Hass, that we're really looking at that work as a bit of a two-stage effort, a structural first stage and then a substantive second stage. The structural first stage is well underway. We have effectively merged the organizational elements of the staffs and the work that they do related to the two boards. There's a joint executive committee of the board itself that has now formed, and its members have been seated, and so we're moving forward quite quickly in terms of setting the structure in place that can then begin the work collectively of things like purchasing strategies and those sorts of issues that will be the longer term work of the merged board.
After you're done, what will be, how do you, or maybe I'm getting too far ahead, what will be left of each program, and what does that look like?
That's probably 2 weeks in. I'm not sure. I've got a whole lot more than the one I just gave you.
Yes, Senator Thatcher.
Thank you, and thank you for being here, and you're kind of in the hot seat after only being here, 2 weeks, as you're saying. I appreciate your talking about closing a chapter, opening a new one, but as was stated previously, it would require a culture change, and I'm not feeling totally confident that getting rid of three people who were named is going to actually change a culture. I think it's going to take a lot more than that. In fact, I think there are still people there who are involved, but we just don't know who they are. In fact, I think that I think I know the answer to this particular question, but and I think the answer is no, it is not ethical for a government agency, whether or not the behest of a PR company they've hired, to treat any regulated entities that are in good standing, as was the case here, differently from their competitors. Now, that would be whether for the purposes of promoting them, disparaging them, sharing information with everybody but them, or with them but nobody else, extracting resources inequitably from an entity in relation to their competitors. I think that would be an answer of a no. But how are you, as hopefully the person that will be going in there, or presumably as the person that will be going there in the future, how are you going to prevent this inequitability or this unequal treatment of regulated entities that are in good standing within the agency?
Certainly. Chair Riley, Senator Thatcher, a couple of thoughts occur to me. First, I think we need to approach, whether it's our relationship with CCOs through contracts or more broadly through development of policy, or, you know, really any variety of ways that we deal with partners in the work that we do, with a degree of what I call it, business-like rigor in terms of the processes and systems and policies that we follow. I think that my track record and the track record of my colleagues at Department of Consumer and Business Services, where I came from, is actually pretty strong in that area. There are some strong parallels to the rate setting process in the commercial insurance market, where you have a very transparent process, but you've still got issues around confidentiality of some materials and those kinds of things. I think there are skills that I bring with me that can help improve that rigor, and that rigor helps provide a structure that lends to that equitability that you're referring to, but you would like to follow up.
Yes, thank you, and I appreciate that you as a person would be implementing these policies, but how can we as a state ensure that not only this agency, but any other agencies out there that might have this issue, and I do believe there are, how do we ensure that after, you know, you've retired and you want to go on cruises, whatever it is, that this culture, I guess, is sustained over the long haul?
Certainly. Chair Riley, Senator Thatcher, the other thing I was going to say is that although I generally believe that an awful lot of what gets done in an agency gets done from empowering employees at the line level to do the great work that they're capable of, culture really comes from the top in an agency. And so first of all, with respect to OHA, I think I myself and the people that end up in senior roles in the organization really are the guardians of the culture of the agency, and can work fairly quickly to improve that culture where it needs to be improved, or reinforce what I believe is already good culture at a line level. I think transparency, though, is the other answer to your question about the longer term. I think the more transparent our processes and our systems and our policies and rules can be, the easier it is for everyone else and all Oregonians to really keep us honest. You know, again, I'd go back to the rate setting process in commercial insurance at DCBS, where everything from the filings to the conference calls between actuaries to the hearings are live streamed, public record, available on the internet. It's, with all due respect to my colleagues, pretty boring stuff, but it's all out there, and that transparency, I think, helps reinforce and make a culture stick.
Thank you. Anyone else have? Yes, Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Patrick, I have not had a chance to get through all of the different material, but what I'm picking up from the conversation we're having now is that there's a PR firm that was involved in this. I'm not sure if it's been made public. I assume there's still an ongoing investigation as to, is there an internal investigation still continuing within the agency?
Yeah, Chair Riley, Senator Brzezinski, to my knowledge, there was not a PR firm involved. I think that may have been a step that was considered at some point. Given that at the point that I arrived, that the people who were responsible for driving the creation of this plan had already stepped down from their positions, I have not launched a formal investigation. I'm really focused on trying to move the agency forward, do the work we just talked about in terms of instituting and reinforcing a positive culture in the agency, and making sure we get about the business of helping support healthy Oregonians.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, and I think that's what we should be encouraging, but at the same time, it does seem, based on the conversations I'm hearing, we need to make certain that if there are other people that were, complicit's a good word, but I also think it's more actively involved, but maybe because where they were at, they just have not been identified. I just want to make certain that you don't have you're fighting an uphill battle because of this culture thing.
Right.
And so I'm hoping that you have some checks and balances in place so you can, in fact, be on the lookout and making certain that you don't have someone else doing something that we all would be I find unacceptable.
Understood, and I would say that I have reviewed in detail the email record that goes with this plan and feel that I've got a pretty good handle from that email record, which I know you've got access to as well, that, again, the people largely responsible for driving the creation of this plan are no longer in those positions.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to welcome you to Oregon Health Authority.
Thank you.
We have significant opportunities in both OHA and DHS, so I look forward to working for you. You know, Jackson County's had a real problem with the mental health due to some infighting between CCOs and the county, and we're still seeing some of those problems. So I look forward to you taking charge.
Thank you. I look forward to digging into some of those issues as we discussed previously.
Good. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
So I think, Patrick, the one thing I guess is coming back to me is as to how to phrase this. I hope that you have that you're able to deliver the message to the employees in that agency that you're there to cover their back if they come to you as a, lack of better terms, whistleblower and that kind of set. Because that's where I think a lot of this stuff, unfortunately, people feel that they're not empowered to do that. And if they're not empowered to do that, some things can get away to the point of where we're in the news.
Yeah, Chair Riley, Senator Brzezinski, I think you're exactly right. A couple of things. I believe very firmly that I need to actively figure out how to help bad news travel faster than good news. Good news always manages to find its way to you. It's there are problems that people know about early that I need to be able to have visibility into the people that that work directly for me, who operate the various divisions in the agency, need to communicate that same approach, and I think the people that we're bringing in embody that value. I think the other kind of a principle that I articulate is that my job is to help the employees at OHA do their job, and that means providing them cover if they need cover to share something uncomfortable. That means dealing with problems early without making people feel like that they're causing a problem by surfacing something. I've always hated the old saying, bring me a problem without a solution. That's kind of what my job is to deal with the problems that don't maybe have easy solutions. And so that's a big piece of what the team at the senior level in the agency is going to be focusing on.
Yes.
Maybe I'll expand on that a little bit. I hear the word cover, and I have to wince a little bit. Yes, we need to cover the whistleblowers and people who are revealing some of the things that are bad news, but I don't want to see people who were complicit, participatory in this plan being held out as, oh, well, just be quiet. We'll cover you.
Yeah,
that there's a difference. There's a difference.
So. I agree, and I apologize for an inarticulate word choice.
No. thank you. I just wanted to mm-hmm. make sure we're clear on what that means. Uh-huh.
So I want to echo a couple of things I heard, which is, first of all, welcome. And we've had dealings in the past in other agencies in other ways, and I really respect your abilities. I'm confident that you're going to be able to do this work. You've demonstrated that ably, and I wish you good luck in all this. But I want to say we really, really, and one of the things I really want to echo is we really need to make sure that you hear any bad news quickly.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that is inherent is people want to hide the bad news. And we don't want to have that culture in any of our agencies. We want to be sure that all the employees in all of the agencies feel that they can go to their management and tell them the bad news without fear. And I think that's a good way to go forward. So anything else before we...
Well, I don't know if he needs to be here for this, but I appreciate your forthrightness, and I think you always have been when you've come to testify before our different committees over the years and with the different agencies that you've been involved with over the years. But I do appreciate also that you're continuing to investigate. I also feel like, you know, there has to be other prongs to this approach of investigating, and I really, just throwing that out there, and I know I don't have a lot of people who feel the same way, but we as a body, as a legislative body, as a co-equal branch of government, we have that unique position to also investigate and look into this a little more deeply. In fact, we can subpoena some of these people that are involved. We don't have answers. He would not be able to provide those answers, having been here for 2 weeks and looking at the same record we are. I really feel like we are missing an opportunity if we do not also utilize our branch, which we have our own lawyers. We have we have a lot of resources at our disposal, and it's our job to hold the other branches accountable. And I really feel like we're in a unique position, and I'm sorry that we're not going to be moving on beyond that. And I think some people might be reticent simply because there is litigation going on. I think there's been litigation going on for many years. I don't see, I mean, maybe 10 years from now. I mean, if we waited until litigation was over, we wouldn't have the answers. And anyway, it's troubling. I wish we would exercise our authority and demand accountability.
Mr.
And nothing
Mr.
against
Chair.
You.
So, yes, Senator Hess.
Thank you. I'm not sure what else we would do. The people have not been disciplined or reprimanded. They've been removed. We have a new director who has a terrific reputation, mm-hmm. and there's nothing that would hold you back from going forward here. So I'm not sure what else we need to do. We gave this guy a cover, Oregon. Now we're giving him this. You're welcome. I think, if there's more to do, we should do it, but what else would you have us do?
We could compel testimony of the people who were involved.
And it feels to me like that's stomping on the grave, and I don't know that there's anything that's productive.
No. So let me step in. So I think that one of the things that we have a responsibility to do is to make sure that agencies do the right thing. And thank you, Patrick, very much. And I believe that we have a responsibility to watch what goes forward. And I think we will do that. We have no responsibility at this point, I don't believe, to punish. And so I don't know to what end we would do any more in this particular case. I think the governor has done the right thing and has moved forward appropriately. And I think that's our responsibility, is to make sure that the executive branch does move forward appropriately. In this case, I believe they have.
Yes, I understand. And just say, to close the door, that is good. But we don't, in order to open a new chapter, you kind of have to know what your mistakes were, and we don't have all the information, I think, that we need to actually help build that new chapter.
Okay.
That's all.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything else?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I do want to just comment, because it's one thing, I've looked at the exhibits that have been posted, asking someone or having someone come before us. I mean, there's a letter from one of the individual's attorneys basically saying she declines to testify.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, if we had someone here and they potentially could be looking at some type of criminal charges being filed, they're going to take the Fifth.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what we would be able to do except have the show,
right,
and not get anything. And at this point, hopefully, if there is something else there that's criminal, that the Attorney General's office is looking at it or whatever they need to do. I mean, that's
right. And I think we do need to, you know, continue to watch not just this agency but all agencies to make sure that their actions are appropriate and lawful. And I think with that, I'm going to close the committee. Thank you very much, everybody. Committee is closed. Thank you very much, everybody. Committee is closed. Thank you.